Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to invite all the speakers up on stage, as well as the chair, John. Please. So the speakers have done a fantastic job of bringing the global water, how it impacts on food security. Won't you agree with me? Before I summarize in a couple of sentences of all the three speakers, I just want to remind you the blue sheet that you have on your table. We would like to hear from you, your input, how you like the conference. So please fill that up and hand it over up front or leave it on the table itself. But please do take the time to do that. Thank you very much. So it has been an interesting and exciting conference on global food security, and especially when we are trying to reach out the nutritional aspects, which is pretty close to the person who is consuming food, and on the other end, the production, where water is the key issue. We have made the transition from morning to this afternoon with an excellent input from the speakers. So if you go back, Dr. Schultz's presentation, he clearly enunciated to us, we have moved on to an urban population setup as opposed to rural. I think we have crossed over, if I remember my statistics right, and the year right, I think 2006, 2007, we crossed over. We are more in the urban setup. So I really enjoyed hearing how he was suggesting the production to the urban has to come from the population from the rural area, but that balance would change. I'm sure many of you will have lots of questions on that particular issue. And at the end, of course, he did make the importance of irrigation and drainage, how it would impact to the food security globally. Then we moved on to the next speaker, Mr. Ikeda. So he showed us the water agriculture trade nexus, and especially the problem of interconnectivity with the four key aspects, the climate, the water, climate change, of course, the water, agriculture, and energy. So we all know that it is very complex, and I'm sure you will have some input into asking questions in relation to how we can sort out this water, agriculture, and trade nexus. And he gave us the example of the Morocco situation, which I'm sure we can use that example to understand these interactions more. And then finally, the third speaker, of course, Dr. Claudia Ringler. She brought us what more the climate change will do in terms of water and how it impacts on the food security at all levels. So she gave us a detailed data on these factors going from the past as well as into the future. So all three speakers have done this very effectively, addressing the issue of water, especially they have covered all regions of the world in different ways. I think we have an excellent opportunity for us to discuss the issues. And I think Chair John Canelli had done an excellent job of keeping the time frame. So we do have a nice time frame here available for us for discussion. So I invite the speakers, the audience to come forward and line up at the podium, at the microphones there, please. Yes, sir.
I'm somewhat intrigued by the implication of the panel. There seems to be the suggestion that climate change, market forces, and technical innovation will somehow reconcile the tension between global forces, which favor the large, and local forces, which favor small self-sufficiency. I must say that I'm missing something. It may be me, but it seems to me that this tension has all kinds of possibilities that have not really been properly addressed, but only hinted at. So I'm wondering if we could have a little bit more information about how exactly these interactions could work.
Thank you. So there are two possible people we can take on. Please.
Yeah, I mean, I fully agree. So I think our topics were very broad and general, and we tried to cover, you know, a lot. So we were a little bit maybe less people-focused, people-centered as some of the nutrition presentations. But of course, you know, putting things into practice, egg productivity increases to address climate and water challenges require participatory breeding approaches, participatory work with the farmer groups, et cetera. Even the way water is being managed, I mean, we heard from Bart, you know, it requires negotiation processes at the secondary kennel, at the secondary, kennel already, because obviously you have to allocate water across. Here he mentioned 125 farmers. So there is a lot of institutional processes, a lot of governance, management and negotiation processes are going on, and the governance system that's behind appropriate water management is generally water rights. So we need, you know, rights and responsibilities to access water, to respect those rights, and obviously also the responsibilities that go with it. So, yes, there is this whole side of the way water is being managed at the farm and at the irrigation system and then at the basin level that we haven't really, you know, focused our presentations on given the breadth of the of the topic. I'm not sure if that's
no,
the
well,
area.
No, just for clarification, I'm just wondering, and I'm just really wondering, I'm not trying to be negative here, I'm really wondering, though, how much freedom the locals have, particularly smaller, poorer countries, in terms of managing these things, which you suggest are going to be necessary, in view of the global forces. Now, I know we can overstate the global forces, and instead of concentrating on real life happenings, but somehow it seems to me there's a tension here that must somehow be resolved in one way or another, and I don't know what it is.
May I just add to what Claudia said? This is an important question, and this is what I try to address through my country's example, but actually I come from a region which is the MENA region, Middle East, North Africa region, which cannot by any means achieve self-sufficiency. We are now importing half of our food needs. MENA region is importing the equivalent of the average yearly runoff of the Nile River. So we are forced to rely on the international trade. This is very important. Saying that, each country is striving, of course, to achieve a strategic levels of food production. The distress in the international market, which was caused by the export bans, has led many countries to invest elsewhere. And you know about the land grab story, which is actually not a land, from my view. It's not a land grab. It's a water grab, because it is water that is limiting.
Dr. Shum?
You can hear me, yeah? I have not much to add. Maybe that only one thing, that I think that most of the decisions really on water management and food production are taken at the national level, basically. If you see how much of the food produced remains in country, then it is a very large percentage of that food. And the international trade, I don't know the exact figure, but is something like 10%, I hear, that was what I... is about 10% of global food production. But in times of shortage, as Aikadi is saying, then the prices, of course, go up, which may be a big problem for the country, the individual country that has to import. And unfortunately, more and more countries have to import a certain percentage. So the ones who have export come in a much better position, which is good, by the way, for their farmers. We should not always see these things negative. The poor guys are the poor people in the cities, and not really the farming population when prices go up.
Thank you very much. We'll move on this side.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My name is Marco Fioroni. I am with Syngenta Foundation for Sustainable Agriculture, and I have a question for Claudia. In your projection, you're showing major losses of grain production due to water scarcity, and you have three data points in your that one particular slide. What's the assumption with respect to agricultural technology? I'm assuming that the underlying assumption is something like constant technology, or in any case, nothing more than the historical annual yield gains of about 1.4, I believe, percent per year.
Yes, and actually, I think it's actually a bit less than 1.4, but 1.4 has been mentioned earlier today. Again, it depends. Do you take the staple crops? Do you take all food crops? Do you take all crops? I mean, anyway. Do you take all food production? So yes. So in these projections underlying, we have the population, economic growth, and technological change as it has played out in the last decades. It basically is a business as usual scenario where we are not expecting large changes in large technological changes. I mean, obviously, we know private sector is working on, on increasing crop yields, for example, maize, 12 tons per hectare, up to 20 tons per hectare. So, I mean, there are, private sector is working on a lot of great egg productivity increases, and obviously CG and others are working on similar issues in the developing world, and there's more private public sector connections. But just from what we have seen, in the past, it's difficult to see that these breakthroughs, these private sector developments and some of the public sector developments are being diffused fast enough, especially regions like sub-Saharan Africa, given all the other constraints that these countries have, to see any faster growth. But we can obviously do alternative scenarios and see what the impact of water scarcity would be under different technological growth patterns. But so far, this is basically a business as usual scenario. Yeah.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you. My name is is Arne Olsøvig. I'm from Norway. I'm quite impressed with the panel and this presentation right after lunch. I struggle with my own drowsiness, and probably not the only one. But I have a few questions to the panel, and you choose by yourself who would respond to this. One is on urbanization. We have not heard anything about urban agriculture, which has been a topic for a long time. Doesn't that matter at all? That is one question. The other is the whole sustainability part, which I feel has been very little touched upon by the presenters. We need more water. That is basically the message, but I've not heard comments on the sustainability of the present food system, which I think is very appropriate here. Subsiding cities. Jakarta was mentioned. I think that Bangkok is another country, another city that is really going down. does that mean that tourism has a dramatic impact on agriculture? And one final question, which I've been thinking about a lot and which I think is very important to many people, particularly those who are affected by this. Will the next war be a war of water? Thank you.
So who would like to start first? Yeah, please. Please go.
Okay. Thank you for the comments. I will try a few, and I think the others will complement me. Urban agriculture, I think if you look at the total yield that you will get from urban agriculture, it is a few percentages of the total yield, I think. It is really not significant. Another issue is that there is a very rapid increase, especially in the arid and semi-arid area, of irrigation by wastewater, by urban wastewater. That is a very rapid development. We had in the ICID in 2005, and by the way, there have been several more workshops on this. And in 2005, we made a special issue of irrigation and drainage of the reuse of urban wastewater, and it is very significant. So that is significant. But really what people do in their garden or on their roof or whatever, I don't know exact percentages, but it is very little. Sustainability of water. The idea is that if we use more water for irrigation, that we overall need more water. There is an interesting graph I heard very often maize mentioned. If the yield of maize is below 2.5 ton per hectare, then more water is consumed than when you grow maize under irrigation. And the reason is that you get much more evaporation from the soil. So per kilogram product, you use more water under rain fed when the yield is below about 2.5 ton per hectare. You can find that graph. There was in the World Water Forum a session on agriculture and water for poverty alleviation and reduction of hunger. It was topic 2-3 in the World Water Forum, and there is a synthesis paper about that that you can download from the website of ICID, because ICID was the coordinator, and there you see that graph. So irrigation not necessarily mean increase in water use compared to the production of the same amount of crop from rain fed. Sustainability is, of course, a crucial issue, especially with respect to groundwater, because groundwater tables in the arid and semi-arid zone are declining in some regions very fast, and you can simply not extract more than is annually supplied, so you have to be very careful there. Subsiding cities, I don't think it is really just the tourism. It may play a certain role. But the problem is that these cities are all in the coastal lowlands, and they extract groundwater for the drinking water supply and to a certain extent for industrial water supply. And you mentioned Bangkok, that's right, that is 4 to 5 centimeters. A city of Bandung is even 15 centimeters. So that are really big problems. The government feels unable to stop those extractions, although it is officially forbidden. And the only thing you can do is to change that extraction to surface water supply, which is basically possible. But then really government has to take the initiative. And you should stop, of course, the big extractors, which is not so easy in those countries. I think that is what I like to respond
Thank
to.
Thank you. Any other panel members would like to say?
Just to add to what Bart said, with regard to more water and the sustainability issue. I think for the last two decades, there were a perception that agriculture, being the highest water consumer, we can use it as what I would call the system safety valve. We can just transfer water from agriculture to other uses. Until the food crisis of 2007, we came to realize that to produce food, we need water. You need 1,000 cubic meter to produce 1 ton of grain. So
it is a consumptive use. In the other uses, they are not consumption uses. So efforts should be made really to recycle water, to treat water in the other uses, to reduce those uses in the other sector. And you can see what is happening in Singapore, in Orange County, in California, and many other examples. And there we need the technology. Next will be on water. Well, history did not show that, and over the 260 shared river, and you have the study that has been made, which has shown that there were more cooperation than conflict. And I would like to share with you, I was recently at the summit of the Mekong River, which was attended by the four prime ministers of the riparian countries, and I think China and Myanmar. And when I saw the prime minister of Cambodia standing side by side with the prime minister of Thailand, at the moment where their armies were on the border, and at the moment of a very, very serious political turmoil in Thailand, I came to realize that water had is very powerful in terms of convening adversaries, in terms of preventive diplomacy, and in terms of peace and prosperity. So we will continue to strive for that and fight for that.
Thank you very much. This side, please.
Hi, my name is Marcus Mason. I'm an international development student at McGill. You've talked about three levels of agricultural efficiency, one being land use efficiency, water efficiency, and labor efficiency. To me, innovation in labor efficiency seems unsustainable, as we're talking about food security being measured by access to food for the poorest of individuals in the world. When unemployment exists in absolute terms, it creates the poorest individuals in the world, and they, if they are not involved in agriculture, then we're not assisting them in attaining personal food security. So when we talk about innovation in irrigation methods and agricultural methods which can contribute to food security, it seems to me that focus on water unit efficiency and land unit efficiency needs to be addressed. And I think that local ecological knowledge and local labor-intensive practices have shown great promise. In terms of urban agriculture, if you look at the case of Cuba, urban agriculture was very successful for a long time in maintaining food security for the population. I just would like some feedback on this as members of international organizations and local organizations dealing with this issue.
Thank you. Yeah, please.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very good point. As you said, all of them are important, the land productivity, water productivity, and labor productivity. In the end, it's a question of It's a question of, are you part of the trading system? Do you need to be competitive? Are you getting food imports from somewhere else because you can produce yourself, at a lower cost because your labor productivity might be too low? So, I mean, it's a question if you're a closed country that doesn't receive any food or it doesn't receive anything because it's a closed country, then, you might not care that much about higher labor productivity. But generally, we do want to see an increase in productivity for all land, capital, water, labor. And as you said, water productivity is it's a somewhat newer concept, compared to even land and labor productivity. But all of them are important if you are looking at a more international trade system and comparative advantage, and you should produce where either land, water, or labor are being used the most efficiently. So, as I said, Cuba is a very special case, and history has changed. It was at some point considered a positive case in some areas, but since, again, the international political regime has changed, I think the story is being seen a little bit more negative now in terms of local food security. Yeah.
Thank you. This side, please, Tim.
In relation to the comments of the first question, that the dynamics between global and local types of systems, and trying to make links, as we stated, our attention between the water issues and the nutrition issues. This question is really, directed at Claudia, that really asking you to what extent in the models that you presented, is there more than the major commodities of maize, wheat, and rice? And to what extent do these models take into account the potential for drought-resistant crops like the sorghums, the millets, the pigeon pea and other legumes, cassava, and local vegetables? And are there alternative crops, which are typically the crops that are part of the local subsistence systems? They offer the nutritional quality in many cases and the diversity of diets that we're looking for. The question is, are they accounted for in these models, and what is the potential for the future?
Yes. Just
a quick answer, yes. Most of them are accounted for, but not all. I mean, everything that the FAO more or less has or is accounting for, we can account for because we need a globally consistent database that we're using. So we have sorghum, we have pigeon peas and chickpeas because we have had a project with ICRISAT, and we have the roots and tubers, the vegetables and fruits and sugar. But because cereals are still 75% of calories that are being consumed, so that's what most people are interested in, and that's still, when we do a presentation, we generally focus just on the cereal crops. But in terms of the further linkage with nutrition, we have actually done very little up to now. We've had one activity with Harvest Plus, and there is, I think, one paper that has come out that where we are disaggregating, using these USDA food tables, disaggregating into the micronutrients and the nutrient contents, of the foods that are being made available for consumption under alternative scenarios. But I think a lot more can be done and should be done in that area. And definitely we still come more from the supply side and not that much from the nutrition side. But again, that's an area that I agree should be moved further forward.
Thank you. Please.
Hi, my name is Jeff Moore. I'm a McGill grad, and I'm an entrepreneur with an impact investing firm. I have a question about desalinization techniques, existing technologies, and all of the R&D that's going on now with these technologies. What are your views in terms of, the coming years, the role that these techniques may play, pending breakthroughs potentially, but in terms of, cost-effective and energy-efficient technologies that either, again, exist now or may exist, and the overall, role in addressing some of these issues.
Well, in our part of the world, desalinization is not an option, it's the option. And, of course, we are following the technological progress, the prices went down, and it becomes desalinization is becoming competitive even for growing high value crops with 45, 50 cents the cubic meter, it becomes very competitive. But of course, there are concerns with regard to energy, especially for those countries that are not oil producing countries. And now I also just came back from the Gulf, a serious concern about the environment and the marine environment with the salt return to the sea and salt content, which is increasing dramatically. So these are serious issues.
Yeah, I just want to add on from our own departmental past historical work that has been done, desalination through draining, adding excess water into that and then wash out the salt, that has been a method which has proved very useful in terms of desalination and putting the crops back into the production. So that's definitely one of the alternatives.
Sam? Thanks. Sam Gamada, Agriculture Canada, also McGill grad, Mac grad actually. just to be more specific. A couple of questions. The first basically stemming from a comment that Mr. Aitkari made about the land grab and, as you added to it, the water grab. Issues around that, it's interesting that Ethiopia, a country that I'm originally from, is using this in major ways, and it could ironically become the breadbasket of places like the Middle East while still at the same time suffering food insecurity. It's interesting that there isn't much institutional or donor agency comments on these types of things, and it hasn't been discussed much, so perhaps comments related to that. The second question I had is the influence of land use on water, especially in terms of its timeliness, and things like deforestation and the impact of that, where you can have flooding and droughts within the same season, and how the hydrologic cycle is affected by land use, and you know how that could be addressed. Those two questions. Thank you.
Well, on the issue of land grab, I think we should distinguish this from the foreign investments that all countries are looking for attracting, and they are important for the development of the agriculture. They are important to access the international value chains and so on. So this is one thing. The second, the land grab, as the media reported it, and what happened in Madagascar and other places, that's another issue which really requires that we look at it and maybe think about a code of conduct in order really to make a win-win deal within the country, and the government have an important role, and on that in terms of looking at the impact on those population who we might lose their assets. This is an important issue. We next week we have the World Economic Forum, which will be held in Marrakesh, and it is on the top of the agenda.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I mean, also on this land grab in Ethiopia. I was in Ethiopia when some of these issues also came up, and like someone said, oh, it's not going to be a problem because the, you know, land for biofuels and land for others, it's only the land that's currently cannot be used productively at this point, and but then there is no such map. So it's, you know, it, as you said, it's a question of vested interests, of power, like who gets, I mean, it's often the Ministry of Finance that, you know, does the deal and gets the financial resources. And so there are definitely problems in terms of, because usually no land tenure for the local, you know, the local populations that live actually on that land. And as Mohammed has said, yes, there is a lot of talk about this international code of conduct. The elements have been proposed. I think the International Land Coalition is working on that, and with lots of other partners, I believe FAO, I'm sure the World Bank. So things are being done, but, you know, at the same time, there is this issue that governments do like to attract foreign direct investments, and if the deal is being made with a powerful ministry, then it's very difficult, you know, to get changes, because obviously we are talking about country-led development, country-led strategies. If the countries decide to go down this route, all you can do in the end is, you know, to establish this international code of conduct. In terms of flooding and droughts, yes. I mean, in agriculture, we still talk mostly about droughts as an adverse impact of climate change, climate variability, but flooding is increasing in importance. I mean, countries like India, they have usually both at the same time. So you have the floods in that part of the country and the droughts in the other part of the country. And floods generally create more damage in monetary terms. Droughts are usually underreported, are in more remote areas, have often not as much, you know, in overall monetary damage, but more food security damage. But it's very important to look at both issues, because obviously both affect not only food production, but also health and nutrition. I mean, floods very obviously with cholera and diarrhea, et cetera, and the droughts because you don't have enough calories. So it's very important to look at both sides of the coin, and both sides are increasing, even in countries like Ethiopia where, you know, floods, where people always talked about famines and droughts and droughts and famines, but floods are also increasing in frequency and intensity. And yes, deforestation is obviously, in parts of Africa, has been an important contributor, and it's surprisingly, it's always being discussed. So when we talk with local populations in East Africa, they themselves usually say, you know, because we've cut down our trees, so that's why we have climate change, or that's why the soil water moisture holding capacity has declined, and say in different terms, but that's there's a very, very strong recognition. Actually, you know, sometimes maybe even stronger than it should be, the linkage, understanding or perception that there is this strong linkage between deforestation and climate change. And then obviously it's a topic you can, you know, you need another seminar to discuss, and variety of people. So I don't want to go further into that.
Okay.
Maybe to add on that, to be honest, I wonder if floods are so much increasing. What is going on is that the impacts of floods are increasing. Our ancestors were not stupid, and they live on the better places. But the problem is that all better places are taken by now, and the expansion of people is in the less best places, let me say, and there may be much more impacts of floods. I mentioned in my talk the city of Jakarta. It was 2 million people by 1972. Now Jakarta has 10 million people. That means that for 8 million people, the storage areas have been removed, and the cities discharge more rapidly. So the urbanization has increased the impact of flood, but the magnitude may be the same or maybe slightly more or less, I don't mind. The other issue here is that it is very important to make river basin plans. And even if it is more countries involved, that is a very difficult thing, by the way. In Europe, the European countries have agreed to make river basin plans jointly, but so far no plan is ready yet. They are still struggling to get the plans finalized. The Mekong was mentioned just before. Mekong it is a very interesting example, because in the Mekong there is a plan for 11 new dams. So if this really materializes, the hydrology of the Mekong River will completely change. Vietnam will not see any sediment anymore in the delta, And there's a far-reaching impact in a river basin. So you only can solve that by joint agreement of riparian states, but I wonder if they are able to achieve that, although I share his opinion that I think there will not be wars about that water.
Thank you. Please, Professor.
So, it's Van Nguyen. Also, I'm from McGill. I'm director of the Press Center. Also, I'm involved with the Global Climate Change Center. So my question when I attended this meeting is just from the impact community viewpoint, because I have seen, I think many of us have seen, in many international conferences, all the nice photo or nice figure about the global scale, the impact of climate change. But I think it's important that we have to look at the problem, like the question raised so far, is in the local scale of a watershed or a community. So that's why I think we have to be careful. That's why my question raised to the panel is there any really local study to see the impact of climate change? Because those models are completely unreliable. I can tell you very well, the regional climate model or GCM model completely cannot capture precipitation at all. That's what I give lecture in many places. So I think we have to be very careful when we talk about even precipitation, because that's the very last global scale the climate scientists provide to us. I can show you two models, the Canadian model and the Hadley Center model, completely two different answers. There's no change in the Hadley Center model for the extreme rainfall in Canada. So if we scare people, I can show the Canadian model, show very big increasing of extreme rainfall. So I think it's important because we're dealing with the impact of climate change to look at the problem at the regional and local scale, because all the math is completely unreliable. That's what I think we have to be careful with that. And in particular, the evapotranspiration math is completely unreliable. That's why I think we have to be careful.
Please. Yeah, you
want to
make a comment?
Yeah. I'm very quickly, and then I think Mohammed can talk about Morocco. We heard this morning about, for example, the Arctic experience, where the people really document experience a change in, for example, the ice density. There have been at least, I'd say, 30 to 50 surveys have been done, both surveys and a lot of participatory research in various countries in Africa, just talking to the people about what changes they have experienced over the last 20 years, over the last 30 years in terms of climate. A lot of local experiences, that's where also, as I mentioned, the tree story comes out. In some countries they say it's God's will. We have not done God's will, that's why the weather has changed or is changing. So there's a lot of very strong perceptions that temperature, actually more so in rainfall, but also in temperature, that temperature have gone up. And obviously we also have some local observations from local weather stations that most often, but not always, corroborate what the farmer perceptions are telling us. So yes, there are a lot of studies. It's a question where you focus on. But then I think Morocco, as we have seen, is strongly affected, and there's some agreement, quite a lot of agreement among the climate models, and for example, on the impacts for Morocco. And I think Mohammed can tell us more about that.
Thank you. Thank you, Claudia, and thank you for this question. Just to say, first of all, I used Morocco because as an example. I didn't want to I just say this is the example because that Pascal's principle that I referred to invite us not only to understand the linkage but to contextualize. We need, and this issue of food security need to be contextualized. There is a lot of differentiation that needs to be done from different parts of the world. And now getting to climate change, of course, it is well recognized that this global model really cannot be used without serious downscaling, if you were, to deal with local and national and even sub-regional issues. And this is the raise exactly the question, the message that I wanted to convey. Because of that, we need analytical capacities, and we need data. And data is the most limiting factor. Just an example, to study climate change attribution to runoffs like the one that I have shown you, that means that you have access to daily flows. And on rivers that are not anthropogenically affected. And this requires a lot of analysis, and I think we need really this kind of capacities to be developed in countries, and we are very much investing in that.
Thank you. You have been very patient. Please.
Noel Solomons from Harvard. Not McGill, but we can all agree that Harvard might be the McGill of New England. This morning we started with food security, and the very first talk was by Professor Ashog on food as a human right, a principle long established by the United Nations. And what I haven't heard in this first presentation, perhaps in the second, and I hope so, is the recent news on the 28th of July of the UN Assembly's resolution with the declaration of the access to clean water, sanitation, and hygiene as a human right. We've been talking in technical terms about water and allocation, but the same human rights, governance, and demand framework which Dr. Ashok spoke of this morning, as of July, with 41 abstentions, applies to water, clean water, hygiene, and sanitation. So I wonder how that tends to overlie the considerations that you have all spoken on.
Thank you. Yeah, please.
I personally have a big concern that we say that 80 to 90% of the increase in food production has to come from existing cultivated area. That means a higher yield per hectare or double cropping or those type of things. And that will most probably require more application of chemicals in the agriculture. We have had that problem in Europe, that the farmers gave much more chemicals, and we got very polluted water of this because of this. It has been a long way to get that under control again. So Europe now, we are not where we want to be, but by very heavy environmental legislation, farmers may not apply so many kilograms per hectare, and so it has been achieved that the drainage water is quite okay, quite up to standard. Not as we want to have it, but we are getting close to it. It was a process of about 20 years. Now, you will get a similar process, especially in the emerging countries, not so much in the least developed countries. Well, they will buy less fertilizer and pesticide. But that is a big concern, together, of course, with the pollution of the cities. So I know that China has entered in the principal political decision to treat its wastewater and is heavily investing on it. To give you the example what it may mean for a society, the Netherlands has to pay 5 to 6 billion euro per year for water management. And out of that amount, 65% is for water quality control. So that is, and only 35 is water quantity control and flood protection. So it will be a heavy burden for a lot of societies in the future to keep the water as you like to see it and as I like to see it, especially because of these requirements for agriculture.
Thank you very much. Please, I guess we just crossed 3:15 time, so I guess I would like to close the session. John, you have anything to say? So if not, please join me in congratulating a wonderful job that the panel has done. And you have been a great audience. Thank you very much. And I know I got lots of technical support. Thank you for each one of you. And thank you for the organizers.